I'm John Batzer. Professor Macinder is here of International Relations. We are discussing the Kremlin, Moscow, the Russian Federation, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire. In other words, the man who sits in the Kremlin is Vladimir Putin. I name him a philosopher king. There are other opinions. And one of those sharp disagreements is held by Washington, not just the Biden administration, the Trump administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, continuing back to the Cold War, and by Congress, both parts of Congress. And I would say that you can count, you don't even need one hand to count the friends that Russia can find in Congress. However, now the question is, how has the U.S. responded these last months and years to Vladimir Putin consolidating his power in the Kremlin and the near abroad now coming under his boot? The near abroad is the borderland all around Russia. This is a vast country. It is the pivot nation. It is the heartland of Eurasia, the world island. And no matter what you say of the demography of Russia or of the prosperity of Russia, the GDP of Russia, that it's a gas tank with an army, it is impossible to ignore if you're going to hold together the world island. However, the U.S. has provoked, has poked sticks, has sanctioned, has done everything it can to make Russia what? Back down, back off, say it's sorry, apologize. Most recently, there is an operation underway. The professor named it Sea Breeze. NATO countries participating in a show of
much force. More than NATO.
Much more than NATO participating in a show of force that extends into the Black Sea, which is a Russian lake. Extends up to the shores of Crimea, which is a Russian naval base, nuclear-armed naval base, I mentioned. And there's also the provocation of expanding NATO, as was promised would never happen under the Clinton administration, right up to the borders of Belarus, right up to the borders of Russia. The expansion now entertains that Ukraine could be a member of NATO, that Georgia could be a member of NATO. So, Professor, I turn it over to you. How has the U.S. responded in a way that brings us to peace and not to provocation that Russia can only answer with warships and gunfire?
Well, I think that our response, not for the first time, is riddled with self-contradictions, is muddled, and it's characterized by no sense of the goal that we are steering for. In other words, what sort of Russia do we realistically want to see? And that accounts for the signaling of weakness at the Biden-Putin summit, which has then encouraged the Russians to try to break up Europe, which is getting harder to do. But it also, what are we going to do? The president of Ukraine is coming to the White House next month. And what are we going to say? Ukraine is the second largest country in Europe. It's bigger than any of the countries in Western Europe, bigger than France, bigger than Germany. It's increasingly well-armed, sophisticated, and it is if you think of Russia has always felt that her power must extend down to the Caspian and to the Black Sea and to include sort of the top parts of those and the lands in between. And right now she's not in that position. Now, on the one hand, we say that we're trying to talk to Russia, although I don't see any evidence of the kind of detailed day-to-day diplomacy involving highly skilled diplomats discussing and chewing over all of these issues. I don't see any of that, any evidence of that from our side, nor have I heard anyone on our side articulate what we want, except that we're against war and we're against unilateral land grabs, but that's of no use. So what we're doing is, on the one hand, we're trying to calm Russia, and on the other hand, we're doing things such as you mentioned, extending NATO, talking about a process of Ukraine acceding to NATO. Now, we can't have it both ways. I think that Ukraine and Russia could have a relationship like the United States and Canada if, in a sense, they were two different countries and had two different histories. But there's nothing inherent. What puzzles me about the present situation is there's no inherent need for conflict. It all has to do with national pride, territory, and so forth and so on. But we are steering in two different directions.
I want to push a little farther on this because the apparent policy of the Biden administration is unclear to me. There was that gesture of not continuing to arm Ukraine, but Ukraine is imprecating all of Washington, not just the Biden White House, for aid. It's become a talking point for the opposition, for the Republicans, that Biden is not giving Ukraine what it needs to defend itself. It's certainly critical to Eastern Europe, which is alarmed at the possibility that Ukraine can be pulled apart and no one will challenge it indefinitely, because you could pull apart pieces of Eastern Europe as well. We know this, and their fear extends right now to an article that you brought to my attention, Professor, which is that the Baltic states fear infiltration, immigration, migration, border crossing by citizens fleeing the dictatorship of Belarus. So what we have here is a Washington that continues to poke and provoke, not a Washington that sees a remedy other than a contest of wills, a contest of bullies. I don't know how to characterize it. But
well, I think there's a conflict, as you put it, of virtue signaling, because we have to decide where we're trying to go. Take the example of Belarus, which is not a particularly important country except for her location, about the size, a little bit smaller than all of Korea. And Belarus has now, we have sanctioned them very, very hard, particularly on their oil exports and potash exports and so forth. But is it in our interest to sanction Belarus in such a way as to force her to draw closer and closer to Russia? Arguably, what we should do is say, yes, Lukashenko is an SOB, but basically in Minsk, that's all you've ever found throughout history. So don't expect to find sort of George Washington there. And having said that, our interest would be to give Belarus an opportunity to join the near abroad, which would mean Moldavia, Poland, and so forth, and detach yourself from dependence on Moscow. Putin is trying to unify the two, and Lukashenko is interested only in keeping his own power. I point out that there's a degree of unrest in all of Putin's empire, they've arrested 11 people in the last week, 8 people in Magadan. Magadan is the back of beyond. I mean, this is a horrendous former slave. What are they doing? But our policy is not thought through. And one of the reasons you mentioned democracy, it's very easy to say, well, this is a bad guy, so we're going to sanction him economically. Well, it may be that economic sanctions will mean that he'll look for exits from the sanctions. He'll want to get around them, and he'll go through an exit that leads him right into the arms of your greater enemy or your greater adversary.
One more detail about Vladimir Putin. It's often emphasized that the Russian economy is dependent entirely on energy resources. And a puzzle to me, Professor, what's wrong with that? It serves a lot of nations to have commodities to sell for prices that are attractive. Why is Russia knocked because it doesn't have a diversified economy? I recently read a summary saying that Vladimir Putin is an old-fashioned person. He fears debt. He fears inflation. And they have I believe their books are positive. I'm not certain. I can't quote this to you.
No, I think that's right. I mean, we are a very, very bad example of massive borrowing. If you look, I saw a graph the other day of U.S. expenditures versus income, a sort of a red line which zooms up almost asymptotically, and then starting about 2 years ago, the black line, which is income, levels off. So there's just a huge discrepancy growing here. I don't think Russia has that. I think it's a great advantage for Russia that she has the natural resources she does. And I have no, I don't think it's a bad idea to make maximum use of that. However, based on personal observation and everything that I can get my hands on, it's clear to me that the domestic economy is not thriving in any sense of the word, whereas, in fact, the Russian economy, the quality of the Russian population is extremely high. There's an index of education, all of these things. If an effort were made to liberate them so that they could have an economy that was a non-energy economy too, that would not threaten the energy economy. All it would do is make Russia twice as formidable economically. So I would say that Putin's management of that is less than ideal. This is his mistake, not to unleash Russia.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, our conversation about the Kremlin and the philosopher king in the Kremlin will continue another day. This is John Batchelor.